passage before us today, on the surface at least, tells us Jesus' teaching about divorce. But I want to get behind that today. I want to get behind the reason why he tells us what he tells us. And I want to begin by simply making a statement and a thought, by saying that morality is not just some socially constructed set of rules. There are people who believe, and I think they've got some truth in it, in that societies tend to rule themselves by what they understand to be right and wrong. But there's more to it than that. Indeed, society does do that. But as is fairly apparent from different societies who have been extremely warlike and extremely racist or prejudiced or something, societies tend to justify things that they shouldn't justify. We suggest, and the Bible suggests, that morality comes from a higher authority than man, or collectively than man's society. That's the idea I want you to think about today. Moral rules come from God. We know this. But I would like for us to understand exactly how it is suggested, or it is stated in the New and the Old Testament. Morality not only comes from God, but I believe are rules built in the very framework of creation itself. Morality is the way things are, not just some rules that God wrote. In essence, God's morality is reality. I read something this week which I thought was very interesting about George Washington Carver. You realize, of course, that we have peanut butter today, probably because of George Washington Carver and his research on the peanut. That's a very interesting thing to know. What you may not know is George Washington Carver was also a very religious man. And he understood very clearly the sovereignty of God. In one of his books, actually his a biography of George Washington Carver, I read this week. He says, "I asked the great creator what the universe was made for. Ask for something more in keeping with that little mind of yours," he replied. "What was man made for?" "Little man, you still want to know too much. Cut down the extent of your request and improve the intent." "Then I told the creator I wanted to know about the peanut." He replied that my mind was too small to know all about the peanut, but he said he would give me a handful of peanuts. And God said, "Behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth. To you it shall be for meat. I have given you every green herb for meat." And it was so. I carried the peanuts into my laboratory, and the Creator told me to take them apart and resolve them into their elements. With such knowledge as I had of chemistry and physics, I set to work to take them apart. I separated the water, the fats, the oils, the gums, the resins, sugars, starches, pectoses, pentoses, amino acids there. I had the parts of the peanuts all spread out before me. I looked at God and he looked at me." Quote, "Now you know what the peanut is." Well, that seemed like a cute, quaint little story, but I think George Washington Carver was simply trying to suggest that God was the one who was sovereign over all that, and he gave man a certain amount of knowledge to know some things and to learn from what nature had given him. But there are some things that are beyond us picking apart and pulling and maybe fully understanding, like what was man made for, or, you know, what was the universe made for? The fact is, God rules over the universe, and George Washington Carver understood that. God was sovereign over everything. And I would suggest to you that with the same sense of humility, we have to accept the rules that God has given us over us. We designate and understand that Jesus is Lord for a reason. He is not just Lord over creation, he is Lord over our lives as well. And so we begin this morning thinking about Jesus' lordship, the sovereignty of Christ over us. But we have to actually begin with God, with this notion of God that the Bible tells us about. God is the creator and sustainer of life. Go back and read later on today, Genesis chapter 2, and notice how many things that God has both created and provided for man for his well-being. He gives him food. He gives him a garden. He gives him a place to stay. He gives him companionship. God provides all those things for mankind. Now, later on in the Bible, it becomes fairly apparent that Job is struggling with some of the things that God has allowed to happen in his creation. And Job challenges God's understanding of those things when he has to endure suffering at the hand of God, or what he seems to feel is at the hand of God. And so God sort of turns the tables on him. And what he does in chapter 41 is God challenges Job to think about his own life and to think about really who's in charge. Now, he does it within a very interesting way. God challenges Job by talking about this particular beast, Leviathan. Sort of this mysterious thing. We don't quite know. We're not really quite sure what or who Leviathan is. There are a number of things that we think. It could be the whale. Some have suggested a crocodile. Mythologically, this particular idea in ancient Near Eastern literature can be translated as crooked serpent or the seven-headed. So we're not really sure what he's talking about here. We think he's talking about some beast that God indeed has created. I mean, even if you want to go and think of it as a dragon for that matter, you know, okay. The fact is, God describes Leviathan to Job in such a way that, Job, can you do with Leviathan what I can do with Leviathan? Take a look at this. Job chapter 41. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make pleas to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you to take him for your servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? You see, God takes this whole idea of this beast, apparently large, apparently wild, and apparently something that Job himself really can't do much with, and he says, can you do with it what I can do with him? You think about that, Job. Do you really have that kind of sovereignty over the beast that I have created? Even if it were this mythological beast of evil, God can control him. God can do with him what a human being cannot do. And by the way, Leviathan is mentioned in several other passages, like four other passages throughout the Old Testament. But the question here is God versus Leviathan. Job, can you do this? Do you have the strength? Do you have the sovereignty over the things that I have made to do what I can do with them? You see, it is really a challenge to Job. And in a way, as we read through Job, we're sort of somewhat on Job's side and part of this narrative of Job, because Job is wondering, why does he have to suffer? He's been a good guy all of his life. He's done everything he's supposed to do. And yet God has to assert his own sovereignty that, Job, there are some things that are out of your purview that are within mine and mine alone. Any way you look at this, Job is asked to say whether he can handle the beast with quite the same ease as God can handle the beast. And by the way, there are several other beasts in the Old Testament. The behemoth, which we're not sure, we think is probably the elephant or the hippopotamus, we're not sure, chapter 40, verses 15 through 24. And then in other passages, this beast called Rahab, which probably is more the mythological beast of evil. We don't know what that is exactly. But the fact is, God is sovereign over those things when mankind is not. And that's the point. God is the creator, sustainer, and sovereign ruler over everything he's created. There's nothing outside of creation. There's nothing outside of God's sovereign rule. God made everything. But this brings us back to the question of Jesus Christ. And we begin our thoughts about Jesus Christ and his sovereign rule in Psalm 8 that was read this morning. And there's some suggestion in this passage that at first the writer is probably talking about mankind in general, that God has given a certain amount of sovereignty to mankind. And we read that certainly the question is, first of all, asked, what's man that you're mindful of him? Okay, in terms of the size of the universe, in terms of the size of God's mind, in terms of the size of what God has done with the universe, who are we? I mean, we can't even compare the size of our planet to anything in the universe. We're a speck. Man seems to be nothing more than a speck of dust in the whole spectrum of creation. And yet, God seems to be mindful of him. Certainly because he's created man in his own image. He has made mankind to be like him, to be an object of his affection, and vice versa. But as we read the passage, and as we read into the New Testament, into Hebrews chapter 1 and Hebrews chapter 2, it becomes apparent here that on another level, the psalmist here is talking about Jesus Christ. He's talking about having given sovereignty and rule of all things to Jesus Christ. And that becomes an essential fact of the Christian faith. It becomes an essential fact of our faith and loyalty to God. In fact, here's how Paul expresses it in Ephesians chapter 1 and verses 20 through 22. He's talking about the power of God that he worked in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, the right hand, by the way, being a place of authority, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion, and above every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in the one to come. And he has put all things under his feet and gave him as head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all and in all. Jesus Christ is everything. Jesus Christ is given all authority on heaven and earth. He told his disciples that just before he left. His disciples believed him. That the world rebels against the power given to Jesus Christ is part of the warning in the Psalm 2, where the psalmist says, "Why do the nations rage? Why do the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed." Now, the original context there was probably the anointed king of Israel. But who do we know is the ultimate anointed king of Israel and of the entire universe? It's Jesus Christ. Why do the nations rage? Why do they rebel against that? Jesus is in charge, and we need to keep focused in our minds that indeed it is Jesus Christ and no one else that is in charge of the entire universe. Jesus Christ is our creator. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But let's talk about the fact that he is not only sovereign over creation, but the fact that he is sovereign over our behavior. And that's where the whole issue of morality comes in. Now, if we take a look at Mark chapter 10, the passage that was indeed read about marriage this morning, Jesus does something very interesting. First thing we have to realize is that Jesus, when he seeks to justify his whole theology, his whole discussion of marriage, where does he turn? He turns to creation. He turns to the creation account, how things were made, how God designed it from the beginning. Genesis chapter 2, verses 18 through 24 is the very thing that establishes the relationship between a man and a woman. It's there that he defines marriage, that a man shall leave his mother and so forth, and the two shall become one flesh. It's creation that defines that. And it is something that is woven into the very nature of the created order of things. And marriage is something that was created by God himself. It is built into the very fabric of reality. And if we start tinkering with it and trying to change it, we're tinkering with things we don't know anything about. It's like us trying to defuse a hydrogen bomb or something. We get in there and start tinkering around, we're going to blow things up. And we're probably going to blow a lot of things up because we're trying to change what has already been created, and we just simply cannot do that. Marriage was created by God, and it's to that creation account that Jesus turns. He says, "But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female." You see what he's doing? You see how he's reasoning for the foundation of what marriage is? He says, guys, that's the way it was made. Now, we're going to add to that in just a moment the fact that Jesus was there at creation. So he knows that it was made that way because he was the one that made it that way. Moral precepts, all the moral precepts that we have, are founded upon creation, the Creator, and Jesus Christ's role in creation. He has the authority to make pronouncements about moral issues because he was the one who made the rules to begin with. You see, that's the point that as Christians we make to the world. That's the message of the gospel. This Jesus who died on the cross, he not only was the one who died on the cross to redeem us, but he was the God who created us to begin with. It's a powerful concept that no other religion can claim. Jesus Christ was there at creation. And we turn to the book of Colossians to illustrate some of the points that I'm trying to make today. In Colossians chapter 1 and verse 16, we read this. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. The him there is Jesus Christ. Through him, all things were made. See, this sort of, to me, you think about the apostles and the disciples. Before they knew this fact, in the flesh, they're sitting there spending 3 years living, eating, talking to, whatever, with the guy who made the universe. Now, my guess is, had they figured that out from the beginning, they probably wouldn't have known quite what to do with it. They probably would have been so dumbstruck to realize that they had spent all that time, that they were talking to God. There were indications of it all along. The miracles that he performed, you know, the things that he said, just the things that he was able to do, showed them something. They didn't quite piece it together until after the resurrection. And I can only imagine what their feelings were during that 40 days after the resurrection when they finally got him. They finally figured out who he was. Well, you know, John tells us, the Gospel of John tells us something similar to what Paul has just told us here when he starts his Gospel by saying this. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. And John will go on in chapter 1 and verse 14 to say, and the Word became flesh and lived for a while among us. John got it. He didn't get it at first. You know, they would have probably had to spend most of their time on their knees, you know, giving him homage had they really known who he was, because he deserved that homage. And yet, finally, they did get it. I think they didn't get it because he didn't really want them to kind of get it just yet, you know. But after the resurrection, this is what they write. This is what they realize, who he was. You know, it was almost like, you know, we figured this out almost too late. Not really, but kind of almost. But once they got it, what did it do? They ended up turning the world upside down because of what they had experienced and because of who they knew that he was. Now, the Apostle Paul, if we go back to Colossians, you will notice that one of the things he does here is when he begins to talk about morality, he's already given us the foundation for that morality. The foundation of the morality is what he says in Colossians 1. Jesus Christ is the creator of heaven and earth. And when we start talking about all the rules of creation and all the rules of the way mankind is supposed to live, well, guess who is the author of those? Jesus Christ is the author of those things. And so when you get to Colossians chapter 3 and Paul starts talking about various moral precepts that he says, here's the way you're supposed to live, he starts in chapter 3 by saying, if then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Now, Paul is doing two things here. Number one, he wants us to think about life on a higher plane. He wants us to think about life coming from heaven. But the second thing he's trying to do here is he's trying to demonstrate Christ's moral authority over all those things. Christ is in heaven, where? Seated at the right hand of God. That's why Paul can go on to say all the things that we're supposed to do and say them with authority. He has the authority of Jesus Christ to tell us these things. And chapters 3 and 4 list so many of these moral precepts, we'll just touch on a few of the high points. In verses 5 through 10, he talks about all those fleshly behaviors that are not part of the reality of creation. Oh, we've made them. We've perverted what creation is. He will talk about sexual immorality, evil desire, covetousness, and various other things. He says those things are perversions of the created order. Those things are things you're not supposed to do. And you're not supposed to do them because they are perversions of God's created moral order. When you start tinkering with the hydrogen bomb, what's going to happen? You don't know what you're doing. You're going to blow things up. And that's what happens when we start tinkering with God's moral order. In verses 12 through 17 of this same chapter, Colossians 3, spiritual behavior is prescribed. Put on compassion, kindness, humility, meekness, patience, bearing with one another, etc., etc., etc. All the things that we are supposed to do that are a part of the way we're supposed to function properly. These are the moral order of things that make creation work the way it's supposed to work. And he doesn't really even stop there. He goes on later on. He gives advice to wives. Further on in chapter 3, he gives advice to husbands. He gives advice to children. He gives advice to fathers, dads, fathers, husbands. You come in twice in there, okay? Just to make sure you know. He gives advice to slaves. He gives advice to masters. Here's how you're supposed to live. Well, why? Why is because of what he's already said back in Colossians 1. You are to do this because the Creator says that's the way you're supposed to do it. And it really kind of boils down to being that simple. If Jesus is Messiah, he is also Lord. And that is a point that we must never forget. That is a point that is very much a part of our message. It is a message that, if I understand Psalm 2 correctly, that a lot of the world may not want to hear. And it's fairly obvious that some of the world do not want to hear it, because every time you bring up Jesus Christ, people get antsy, or they get, you know, sort of looking askance, or they know inherently that Jesus Christ has some ways that they're supposed to live that they're not living according to. I think that's part of the problem. I think they know instinctively that there is a higher authority that needs to be imposed upon their lives that a lot of us simply do not want to have. It's there whether we want to have it or not. Through Jesus, the world was created. He has the right to make moral pronouncements, and he has the right to tell us and pronounce that marriage is a union between one man and one woman. That's a part of our message. We don't say that because we're smarter than anybody else. We don't say that because we're more righteous than anybody else. We say that because we believe that indeed he is the creator of the universe. We believe that he's seated at the right hand of God even now, ruling over history, ruling over the world that indeed he created. He has the right to determine all of human behavior. He created us. He created the rules. This is the Jesus that you accept when you obey the gospel. When you made your confession that Jesus is Lord, you were confessing that he is not only the Lord of your life who died for your sins, he's the Lord over all creation. He's your master. You owe him your loyalty and your worship. When you are baptized for the remission of sins, you are being baptized into the death that Creator God did for you. You are identifying with him in his death, in his burial, and in his resurrection. And when you are raised to walk in newness of life because of the gospel, you can know that you have life because he was the one who created it to begin with. He has the keys of life in the palm of his hand. Maybe we could be even more specific. It's in his mouth because he did it by simply speaking. And so his word is life. Jesus himself is life. And we urge you today to remain faithful to that life because indeed, it is the only source of true life for your life.